This is a recording of Ray Trevis, 36 Bowes Hill, Rowlands Castle, made on the 8th of April, 2009.
Right.
Well, I'm ready?
Yeah.
Well, I'm Ray Trevis, and I was born on the 23rd of September, 1930. And I was born at Prospect Farm, which is Prospect Farm. And that was mixed farming, which really means that's crops and dairy. What do you want to know about that farm? Mm-hmm. Well, this was a tenant farm of about 190 acres, and the owners was Portsmouth City Council. Originally, it belonged to Fitzwigram, but became Portsmouth City Council in the 30s. On the farm, the dairy herd was about 27, 28 milking cows and about 10, 12, 15 heifers, three horses that was used for all cultivation, and the crops was basically oats for the horses, wheat for whatever wheat was used for in those days. No barley was grown, and the rest was grass. And then in the 40s, sugar beet was grown because they wanted sugar beet. They wanted sugar during the war, and potatoes was grown. But in the war, you had to grow crops. If you grew crops, you had to grow a specified number of acres, and you had to grow them in a particular part of your farm. This was laid down by the Ministry of Agriculture, and often this advice was wrong, bad. Then my father died in 1969, and it became taken over by the Little Lee Farm to make one part of it, and about 100 acres became buildings, and that is all that which is the south side of Wakefors Way. I think you better pause for a minute. Well, in the 30s, all the cows were milked by hand.
What was the breed of cow?
Shorthorns. Mm-hmm. And a good milker would milk 4 an hour. So if you had three milkers, you could do 12, so 2.5 hours you'd get through your dairy herd. And then in about 1941-42, it went over to a milking machine. Not milking machines as you have today, but you have basically three units. And these units are, each unit consists of a container on top of which is a cluster, what we call the cluster. And the cluster is put onto the teats of the cow, and when it's full, you change it over and go to your next cow, and it's all manual. And you could basically, if you were very quick, it was all carry the milk to the cooler. It was not, didn't go through pipes or anything like that like you would today. If you were very quick, you could milk your cows in about 2 hours, one man. And originally, after milking with a machine, somebody came along and stripped the cow because the last bits had to come out. And in order to get the last bits out, quite often they put a brick up the base of the cluster to give added weight to this. And then all this went by. And one of the big problems that we have with all cows was mastitis. Mastitis, if you when you look back at it in retrospect now, but you washed every cow with a rag and warm water. And of course, if you had mastitis, you could easily transfer that to the next cow. And if you compare that with today, where, for example, all the milk goes through pipes to the cooler, it never even comes in contact with the air, which it did then, because when you took the top off the cluster and put it onto an empty one, air got in, and when you put it, when you put the milk up into the top container to come down through the cooler to cool it, it all went through the air. And in August, you could say if it was sundry weather, milk would last about 12 hours before it went sour. Now, today, if you compare that with today, not only does the milk not come into contact, but also all the cows, it's all automatic. You don't want this, do you?
I'm recording.
No, do you want to know what it's like today? Compare.
No, I don't need.
You don't? No. Now, in the beginning of the war, the milk was collected once a day by somebody called Millington, who had a lorry, and he used to go round the farms and collect all the milk from the farms, and he was based at Bedhampton. And then in 1940, my father set up his own milk round, or 39-40, set up his own milk round. And we used to bottle our own milk, and the pint bottles and the quart bottles, before they came in with this milk round, we used to go round with a pony and trap, round with churns. And we would go and dip your quart measure into the churn and put it into the lady's jug. And many, many customers had a gill of milk. If it was a single lady living by herself, all she could afford was a gill of milk. Well, our best customer lived in Drayton, and she had 4 pints of milk. And because she was a good customer, she demanded 3 deliveries a day. And we used to take her one for breakfast at about sort of 8 o'clock. And then we used to go back at lunchtime and give her a second delivery. She thought we'd gone back and milked the cows, but in fact we'd taken the milk round Drayton and then gone back at 12 o'clock. And then we did go and get her some fresh milk from the afternoon milk and take it back to her in the evening. And now you've got to imagine that we were taking a horse and cart through Drayton.
No?
And then during the war, the government stopped that because from horse and cart we went to a van. So in about 1942-43, we were now having a van going around all these places, and in order to conserve petrol, the ministry made a rule that only one milkman was to go down one street to save petrol. That was the rule. And so our dairy was taken over by Gauntlet and Walkers, or Walkers and Gauntlet. Can't quite remember. That's that.
So where was your milk round then?
Well, we'll finish. We'll just go through it first. I mean, first of all, I'll tell you that I became 5 in September 1935, and my mother would not let me walk to school until the spring because it was a mile away and you didn't have transport in those days. You had to walk to school. And my teacher was Miss Baker, Miss Bay Baker.
At St. John's School.
At St. John's School, which is now a private building. And we had double desks. And next to me was somebody called Derek Elsbury, who was called Quack Elsbury, obviously. And behind me was Dorothy Sweetnam and Rosemary Murrant. And Miss Baker used to set your sums. And then when you'd done them, you took them up. And if they were right, she didn't put a tick, she did a sort of a scrawl sort of thing like that. And I suppose I could tell the time, because periodically I was sent out to look through the window of another classroom where there was a clock to come back and tell her what the time was. I don't know whether she wanted to know what the time was or just to get rid of me. I don't know, really. And occasionally, we were taken into the next classroom, I don't know why, where Miss Grace used to teach. And they used, the only thing I really remember about that was they would have to all stand up, and like one of these, what do they call them, one of these things that tip the time, it begins with M, doesn't it? Stand up, and like a metronome, they would be going backwards and forwards, and they would be saying 1 times 8 is 8, 2 times 8 is 16, 3 times 8 is 24, and I can, that really impinges itself on my mind. Well then, when I was 7, I was taken away from there, and I went to Manor House School, which was run by Dr. Wallace, and that was in South Street in Havant, and it was a private school. And then the war came in 1939, and Hilsey College was evacuated out to Lee Park House. That's where they boarded, and the school was in Wesley House. And because that was at the bottom of Prospect Lane, my mother took me away from Manor House School and put me to Hilsey College. And then they stayed there for a year and moved to Basingstoke, and my mother took me back to Manor House School. Went back to Manor House School, and I can remember Mrs. Wallace saying, "Well, you're back again, are you?" And then when I was 11, I went for an exam in the headmaster's study of Mr. Steadman at Purbrook High School, and I had to write an essay, and I had to do a number of sums, one of which I can remember quite clearly. It was something, went something like this, that if 10 paraffins used, if 10 lamps used 2 gallons of paraffin in 5 days, how many lamps would use so many gallons in so many days? And I had no idea how to do it, but my headmaster, he found out that my name, what my middle name was, which was Gauntlet, and his neighbour was the Gauntlets in Stakes Road, and so he let me come into his school, I think, basically on my parentage rather than on my ability. And then I stayed there until 1948. I left in 1948. Originally used to pick up the little bus, little sort of single-decker bus at Havant Church, St. Faith's Church, and used to take us up over the hill to school back. And then I had a serious accident in 1948, and spent the next 7 months in hospital.
Which hospital?
Royal Portsmouth Hospital.
Royal Portsmouth.
Which was at the top of Commercial Road, as it was then. Opposite, I think, All Saints Church. And I was in Lapthorne Ward. And I was having an operation once a week. Various operations. The ward was run by a sister, Bacon, who was a right martinet. Everything was absolutely run like a regiment, really. And I went in there in November 1948, and I came out in June 1949. And while I was in hospital, the headmaster, Mr. Steadman from Purbrook, came round to see me, and he said, "Well, what are you going to do now? You're going to come back and take your A-levels again?" And I said, "No, Mr. Steadman, I'm not going to do that, because I'll be nearly 21 when I take them." So he said, what are you going to do? I said, oh, I don't know. So he said, well, I'll come back in a fortnight, 3 weeks, and we'll see. And he came back and he said, well, I think you ought to go in for teaching, because I didn't know how, in the future, what result of my accident would be. And my father heard, he said, well, I think that's a good idea. It's £1,000 at the top of the skull, you know, and it's pensionable, which was very true. He being a farmer, tenant farmer, he knew that he didn't have a pension, so to him pensions was a very important facet to him. So I applied to King Alfred's College in the October of 49 to enter for teaching in September 50, and I was accepted. In the intervening time, I got a temporary job as a clerk in the civil service. And they allowed me to go to the Royal Portsmouth Hospital on Mondays and Thursdays to have my wounds dressed, because I still had an open wound in my leg. And this carried on until the July of 1950. So I'd come out of hospital in June 1949, and this wound was still causing trouble in the July 1950. And it looked as if it was unlikely that I was going to be able to go in for teaching. Well, I went down for a dressing to the wound on the Thursday of July. On the Saturday and the Sunday, I went on my father's tractor and we were cutting corn. I was driving the tractor and he was on the binder, because we didn't have combines in those days. And then it was a lovely day, sunny day. And then on the Monday, I went in to have my wound dressed, and the wound was full up with maggots. And they washed the maggots out, washed the wound out with hydrogen peroxide, and I waited for the surgeon, Charles Orr, to come round and see me. And when he heard about it, he just fell about laughing. He thought it was terribly funny. I thought they were going to have me back in hospital. And he said, well, your father keeps sheep, doesn't he? I said, no, he doesn't, Mr. Ord. He said, well, he said, the shepherd always puts maggots onto a sheep wound and sort of clear them up. Well, to cut a long story short, the wound was mended in a fortnight. Yeah. And basically, the fly had realized that the wound, there was a lot of dead flesh there, and had gone down inside my bandage and laid the eggs there. And the maggots had eaten all the dead meat.
All the dead tissue.
And then all the dead tissue, and the clean tissue then healed up. And of course, when you hear this now about they're using maggots to clean men, I thought, God, just I did that 50 years ago. Really. And then, well, I went to, I did 2 years. 2 years training to become a teacher, which is rather interesting actually, because directly after the war, men coming out of the war, they did a 6 month course to do teaching, and then about 1948 it became a year, 49 it became about a year, and then when I went in it was 1950, and of course now it's 3 years plus a post-ed, so it's changed quite a lot. I mean, that compared with the 30s, where you went straight into school, you left school and you went straight into teaching as a trainee. You know, you learnt your skills on the job, basically. I don't suppose she went to college, I suppose, nothing like that.
And where was your first appointment?
Copner. I went to Copner School, secondary modern, where the boys were from 11 to 15 in those days. A lovely school, about 220. Very nice staff, very nice headmaster, very family-like. There was no bells. You blew a whistle when they came in, or they stood in lines before they were allowed to come in. And the master on duty would come into the staff room where we'd be playing bridge, and he'd say, "Right, I'm just going to blow up now, chaps." And the chaps would say, "Hang on, Cyril, just let's finish 4 no trumps, then you can do it." So we finished 4 no trumps, and then he would go out and blow the whistle, and then they would come. And there wasn't much money in education those days. In fact, science, where I was, there was £50. We had £50 to spend on science, which was the old penny per boy per week. So if a boy broke a beaker, which was 2 and threepence, that was 27 weeks worth of science up his boat, wasn't it? Think about it. But we made everything. I mean, we made things to show, you know, convection, radiation and conduction. We showed how, you know, telephones worked and things like that. It was very sort of practical science. And a lot of the boys, because it was all boys' school, a lot of the boys left 15 and then they went and did an apprenticeship in the dockyard, did a 5-year apprenticeship. And they had an excellent apprenticeship, and after 5 years they came out and they were top class electricians, top class whatever trade. You know? Then in Portsmouth at that time, in the 1950s, there was, for example, Portsmouth Grammar School, Portsmouth High School, Northern Grammar School, Southern Grammar School. That took all the top flight. And then the next layer was at a technical school, which was at Hilsey, and the building school. And then you had all the secondary moderns. And the top IQ at Copner was 104. Yeah. But it was rather interesting, because although their IQs were not a very high, a lot of them made great success of their lives, because, to put it simply, they were big fish in a small bowl, as distinct today, where many of them are small fish in a big bowl.
Yeah.
Well, regarding the Rowlands Castle Cricket Club, my friend who lived in the nurseries next door to me in Prospect Lane, he said, knowing now that my accident was sort of on the mend, that why didn't I come and play cricket? And so I went up there, and originally I had a runner when I was batting, because my leg was still not properly functional, I suppose. And then we only had about 15 or 16 members, and some of them, like one of them, only played once every 3 weeks because he was a signalman, so he could only get off once every 3 weeks, that sort of thing. And we improved the cricket club because, first of all, we got away matches going, and we visited Hindhead, Slindon, East Harting, West Ashling, Rose at Chichester, Stirling's at Chichester or Birdham, and made it on a reciprocal basis. So they came to us and we went to them. And then we decided to improve the standard that we needed nets. And in order to have nets, we needed money. In order to get money, we decided we'd have a jumble cell. And so we borrowed Sid Pitt's cart, and we went all round the village collecting jumble. Lynx Lane, Bowes Hill, all the place. And we had this big jumble cell in the parish hall, where down one side of the parish hall there was nothing more than ladies' coats. And we made £100 which I suppose in 1952, 53, 54 was quite a lot of money. And Sid Pitt, he put a two concrete slabs down for us up the recreation ground, which are still there, incidentally. And on that went a matting, and we had two nets to improve our standard of cricket.
Did you have the roller?
No, we didn't have the roller. We had a roller, but we had a pool. They've now got a motorised roller. Oh no, it wasn't anything like that. And we decided we needed water to the cricket square, and so two Sunday mornings we dug a trench from the pavilion to down the side of the football pitch, behind the goalpost of the football pitch, and then round to the square. And somebody called Mr. Fowles, who worked for the Portsmouth Water Company, he put in the pipe for us, and then we filled it all in. And I suppose the pipe's still there somewhere. And nobody ever know that you get water to the square, because it's all been, well, it's not looked after now, is it? No.
And can you remember the names of any of the team members?
Yes.
Can you tell me?
Yes. Team members that I can remember were, let's see, Dick Watts, who went to Church's College, where cricket was the headmaster's real interest. And Dick Watts was a very, very good cricketer, and at the time I played he was probably in his late 30s, past his best, but he opened the batting. There were the two Rickard boys, Tim Rickard, now dead unfortunately, John Rickard, who played for Hampshire Schoolboys and England Schoolboys, Dougie House, the youngest member of the House family that lived at 42 The Green, Robert Farr, Graham Fells, Arthur Wells, Brian Cole, Dick Ingram, who now cycles around the village with a great big beard. I think that's all I remember. Eddie Stillwell, myself, of course. I think that's all I remember.
And, recording that.
Well, for the cricket team, we have refreshments. And as far as I remember, sometimes we have the small hall, small parish hall, where the teas were served by the ladies or wives that had made them. But then I think the ladies got a bit fed up with providing teas, and so we were going down to the Robin Hood, I think. We were getting teas there. I think that is really teas, as far as I remember. It was mower for cutting the outfield, but I think, I don't know who cut it. I can't remember who cut it. Can't remember, but we had to maintain the table.
Yeah.
I remember we decided that it needed weed killing and it needed deworming. And so we bought ourselves a Mowrah mill, which is spelled Mowrah. And this comes, I believe, from India. And you spread it all over your grass. And then you water it in, and it's basically as an irritant. And before you know where you are, all around your feet, there was hundreds of worms all crawling on the grass, and you swept them up. That's how you did it. Today, of course, you have a killer which goes in and stays there. Incidents. I can remember when we played Hindhead. Doug House, who was one of our bowlers, he bowled left arm medium fast, and he was the only bowler really we had that day of any sorts, and he bowled 19 overs, and I don't think he'd get his arm up over his shoulder for the rest of the week. That was one incident. West Ashling, they had a chap called Perkins who batted number three, and he always got runs against us, always. We did Perkins, he was a real pain in the backside. He was a good bat though. I think that's really all, you know, incidents I remember.
Did the balls ever go into people's gardens?
Weren't that good. To the recreation ground, you just had a lane. It was all sort of stones, you know, flint, that. And on the left of there was a plot of land, of which now two houses have been built. One of which, the chap who's got the fish and chip shop, lives. And Pop Rickard bought that for £100. I know he bought that for £100. And he tried to sell it for £4,000, and Roy Newman, who refused it, realised later on he'd made a mistake. But that was by the way.
Oh, that's very.
We'll go back before that, shall we?
Yeah.
Well, during the war, the golf club, there was no golf at the golf club. The greens were all roped off and presumably maintained by Mr. Bell, who was a greenkeeper at that time. But all the fairways were not. And my father was in the Home Guard, and he was a part of the platoon that was stationed at Stein Buildings in Links Lane. And his commander, his inverted commas Captain Manwaring, was somebody called Ivor Fry, who was a member of the golf club. And he asked my father whether he would cut the fairways during the war and make hay from them, just to maintain them. Now you've got to remember that when you go back to 1940, most of the trees that you see there were not there. They've been planted since. Most of the drainage ditches that were not there. It was basically more fields, full stop. And in 1940, my father went to Chichester Market and he bought two cars. One was a Morris Isis and the other one was a Singer. And these were a typical 1930s cars, big square cars that belonged to people who could afford them, great big chrome headlamps, running boards, walnut fascias, leather seats, silken handles for the back passengers to hold on to, picnic trays to come out of the back seats, the front seats for the back passengers. And he bought two in Chichester Market, one for £10 and one for £15. And he used these during the war to sweep in, because you had like a sweep fixed to the bumper of the cars, to sweep the hay into an elevator, which was then made, which was then brought to an elevator, which put the hay up onto a rick, and the rick was built beside what is now the 18th Green. And to make the elevator work, you had a horse which went round in circles, and it worked a series of gears, so that the hay was taken up, and sometimes the horse would get tired and they'd say, "Get up, Duke," and the horse would start off again. And of course by the time the rick was made, there was quite a track, circular. And that happened during the war. And at the end of the war, of course, like all typical farmers, when it wasn't haymaking, the cars were left in the stinging nettles. At the end of the war, they were useless. The end of the war, they would have been worth a lot of money, because in 1947 he bought the cheapest, the basic car, a Ford, and £100. Being a farmer, he was able to buy this car for £100. But the rule was you had to keep it for a year. And then he sold it at the end of the year for £400 because cars were short. Well, Captain Mainwaring, that was Stein Buildings. And he was the one that organised this. Now, I didn't have anything to do with the golf club until I joined in 1969. I gave up cricket in 1968, decided to play golf, and I applied to join the golf club on the third week of May. I was a member on the 1st of June. No interview, £20 to join, £15 for three quarters of a year's sum. That was the best and cheapest thing I ever did, because in the late 60s IBM all came in, 70s IBM came in, and everything went up in tremendous value. Oh yeah. I mean, now, I don't know what the situation now is at the golf club, but you've probably got a waiting list of about a year, if not longer, and you're not going to see much change out of £1,700 to join for a year's membership. A year's membership and the joining fee was somewhere about £1,700. That's really all I can tell you about the golf club, really.
Start again, when I joined?
Well, when I joined, the main greenkeeper's complex was Stein Buildings, which is in Links Lane, now private residence. But then they gained access further up Links Lane, and now the greenkeeper's complex is at the end of that lane, isn't it? And also they bought two fields there and extended it. A bit difficult to describe, but the most northern end of the golf club has been added since 1969. Mm. Joined all the greens were watered by a spinner. Mm. Now it's automatic, and all the fairways watered automatically. All the greens were cut by a hand mower. Not cut by a hand mower now. All the work of the maintenance of the golf course is done by people who sit on machines and just go around. I mean, they cut the greens. They can cut a green in about 5 minutes. Well, certainly less than 10 minutes. In those days, I mean, probably half an hour or more. Yeah, half an hour, three quarters of an hour to cut a green. Because what happened was the greens were smaller, and so because they didn't want to play on them in winter, they made a piece to the front which they just used for winter. And over the course of time they become accommodated into the green.
Oh, I see.
So they've grown. The greens in some case could be twice the size that they were. And the 13th green has been completely remodeled. Completely remodeled. And sand bunkers have been bought. Every captain has a little thing he's going to do. I mean, Peter Badger, he was the one who got the Forestry Commission to plant trees. Plant trees all over the place. Two of the main woods are now Peter Badger's little contribution. Mr. Hargreaves, Martin Hargreaves, his little contribution was having bunkers put all over the place. He was a bunker man. Graham Allen, he was the chap who had all the fairways automatically watered. Every captain has to have sort of something to be remembered by, if you might. I mean, you know, got to put his imprint on things. All to the good.
Yeah.
You know.
Well,
Let me turn it on. Mm-hmm.
Well, this house that I'm living in now, we bought the plot of land off Mr. Cousins, who was a builder at West Marden.
And what year was that?
And that was 1958. And Mr. Cousins wanted £750 for the land, and he said, I've been offered 725, and I must have 750. And we bought the land, I suppose, towards the end of 1958. And I wonder what the hell have I done spending £750 on a plot of land. And it was full of trees. He said you won't have to plant pears for your heirs. He said, because they are already here. And I, who knew something about gardening, knew that I was going to root them out and put some decent pears in. And there was lots of, there was other fruit trees, there was raspberry canes, there was goldenrod, there was stinging nettles, there was two hedges. And at the back corner, a pile of stones, which was probably about 10 yards long and about 3 yards wide, where everybody in the road had dumped their stones. Unfortunately, my father was a farmer, so I had access to a tractor, and we came up and we rooted all the trees out, pulled them out of the ground, had a big bonfire. We carried all the stones away and put them down at the appropriate places on the farm. And then when we had the house built, which was started in March 59. No, it wasn't. It was started in March 1960. And it was completed in August 1960.
Did you have an architect? And who
was the builder? We had an architect who worked for the council. Mm. Cheapy.
Yeah.
And the builder was a builder called Blandford, mm-hmm. who went bankrupt soon after he built our land. And it was all built on a shoestring. If we'd had another £500 to spend, all the problems of this house would have been solved. You know, and I didn't put a back wall onto the garage so I could bring the tractor and tractor through to the back garden, and the back garden was ploughed and rotivated using a tractor. So I had access to machinery to it. So that's.
South
Durrance? I do, yeah.
Well, South Durrance, if you go down to South Durrance, when you get to the basement, there is two bungalows on your right in which it's flint faced.
Yes. Flints. Yeah.
Well, in the first one, there's a mixture of a mixed copper. Mm. And as you know, in the first room on the right is a little sweet spot. And she used to have scale, and she would measure out an ounce of aniseed balls.
Do you want me to start again? Shall I start again?
No, I sort of picked up again.
And Miss Cobbett had this sweet shop in South Durrance, and she would measure out an ounce of aniseed balls or whatever, all the different sweets that kids have. And then she'd make a paper cone and put these ounces of sweets in, and then tuck them in. And my grandfather used to give me pocket money every week. He used to give me a shilling, actually, which was a lot of money. And I went in there and I spent sixpence on sweets, the old sixpence, and I came out with 24 cones of sweets. Because an ounce of sweets was a farthing. And we went across the wall, the farm opposite went across the wall, up into the fields, and with the Mulry family, we had a feast. and Mrs. Cobbett, or Miss Cobbett, contacted my father to know whether I had stolen that sixpence. Mm-hmm. Now, just up the road, Dick Ingram, the Ingram family lived, and the elder boy Ingram, I'm not so sure that this ought to go on actually, you see, the elder boy Ingram came down into the village and he turned left into the chapel, and there he met Miss Cobbett's lorry, and he went straight through the windscreen, cut his throat, and he was dead in 2 minutes. And she was a neighbour just living down the road.